Welcome to the 25th episode of the official ESPGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Hello, everybody, and thanks for tuning in. Our guest today is a very well-known pediatric gastroenterologist with a particular specialty, I think, in endoscopy. And we're going to touch on several aspects of endoscopy, what it can be used for, how to use it. Right, Mike Thompson. Mike Thompson, trained in Edinburgh and then south of the border, has been working as a professor in Sheffield and also at the Royal Free in London. Have I got those right?
Just at Sheffield, and then I do a bit of work in London in the private sector. But yeah, okay. I used to be at the Royal Free with John Walker Smith many years ago.
All right. I was working perhaps with an older version of your CV. Who knows? He has some good news. News about a topic on which we touched some while ago in one of the earlier podcasts in this series. Diagnosis, Management, and Prevention of Button Battery Ingestion in Childhood, a European Society for Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition position paper. When we spoke with Lissy de Ridder, she was very keen on bringing this topic to this audience, and Mike proposed that as one of the articles to which he contributed and which he'd like to bring up as well. I think the key message of that paper was get it out as soon as possible, and if it makes its way beyond the pylorus within the first 48 hours, then it's probably okay not to go after it. But that first 2 hours is really essential. Of course, the best thing of all would be to make sure that there are no button batteries within toddler hand-to-mouth range. And Mike tells me that there's legislation making its way through the British Parliament that is aimed to do just that. Tell us more.
Well, thanks, Alex. We've had the Australian legislation, and then only about a month ago, the American legislation, and the UK legislation led by a lady called Jo Gideon, an MP, is getting its second reading in the Houses of Parliament. So hopefully that will be on the statute books not too far away. And it's all about packaging. And that sadly came from a young lady called Harper Lee who died from ingesting one of these. And her parents had the Harper Lee Foundation. They pushed for this to occur. And so we've just been attempting to get the European Parliament to listen to us with Lissy de Ridder and Christos Zivinikas and myself and a few others in the ESPGAN Button Battery Task Force. And hopefully we're going to get some legislation through in Europe as well as the UK in the not too distant future, because these things are, as we know, lethal.
What does the legislation specify about the handling of button batteries? And has it gone far enough, in your opinion?
No, it's not gone far enough in any of the countries yet, actually. The stipulation is really around the objects that the button batteries go into them, so that they're made to be child unfriendly, and the packaging. But unfortunately, the big problem, as you know, is when they're spent, or so-called spent batteries that are left around, and they still have enough voltage to cause significant damage to the esophagus and kill. And it's these ones that we're trying to get legislation, which hasn't yet been attempted, to where, like, if you can imagine, it's something called a back guard. If you put in a supermarket trolley, you put your money in to get the supermarket trolley out. But these are now packaging where you have to put an old battery in to get a new battery out. So there's none left lying around, and that really is the key to this whole issue. So we're hopeful that we'll keep knocking on the door of the legislators and around the world. And the big problem is that the button battery companies getting them to come on board. So that these are key things for us in Europe and in the UK.
Right. That's one aspect of endoscopy, is how to avoid endoscopy, how to make endoscopy to salvage an esophageal crisis unnecessary. But there are times when the crisis is upon you, and you don't know whether you should be doing endoscopy or not. I'm talking, of course, now about acute upper gastrointestinal hemorrhage. That's a real problem in kids. I mean, there are guidelines for when you should sit back, when you should wait, when you should give it a little bit of time, and there are guidelines for when you should jump on that kid, jump on that adult with your endoscope. But such guidelines, are they available yet for kids?
Yes, so very good question. We've published a couple of years ago from Sheffield the Sheffield scoring system for GI hemorrhage, which essentially requires a certain threshold. And we had two sets of patients, and ones that we determined needed intervention when we did the endoscopy, and ones that didn't. And we were able to produce a valid scoring system to determine when and emergently endoscopy was required. And it was based on things like transfusion requirement, resuscitation, large hematemesis, melena, and this sort of thing. And it's got a robust scoring system. So we're pretty much, we know that we can determine when it's necessary. But the big problem, and this is what I'm always harping on about, is that there's a postcode lottery across the UK and Europe in terms of the ability of the endoscopists to actually do something when they find a big bleeder. And it's very variable across the training. So we're really pushing now in ESPGAN for the GI bleeding training to be a very important part of our training structure. And we run big courses for these now, not least the Endoscopy Learning Zone at ESPGAN annual meeting, which is this year in Vienna. So, yeah, really important to get everybody on the same page in terms of GI bleeding treatment. There's a bit of a game changer recently, and that's something called hemospray, which is a little bit of a much easier technique to use than the clips or the argon plasma coagulation or any of the more sophisticated techniques. And you basically spray this powder onto a GI bleeding area, and it makes immediate hemostatic contact. So there are developments that are really exciting, but the most important thing, in my view, is to get people trained properly and get kids dealt with immediately if they have a catastrophic bleed.
Now, my question is, since 2015, when you presented that set of diagnostic guidelines, have they been widely adopted? What's the uptake among pediatric gastroenterologists? Are people using them?
Well, we're using them in the what the Americans would call the emergency department, or A&E, and rolling them out across the UK. We're coordinating a larger study with some of the North Americans to try to do a prospective study. The more that people understand that the adult guidelines are really not applicable to paediatrics, the more we hope they will take up this particular guideline, because there isn't another one out there for children.
Where do they diverge? What are the points that mislead a paediatric GI person?
Good question. Well, you will know that a lot of the guidelines, they rely upon other parameters such as a different heart rate or the presence of urea or whether there's cardiac failure or whether the person has had coronary artery disease. All these things that are mainly adult-orientated, which are totally irrelevant, of course, to children.
Gotcha. Okay, you've got the guidelines, but you don't have enough kids to train people. Are you going to come up with a GI bleeding resusciani?
We have one, yes.
No, you don't. Yes. Come on now. Okay, tell me more. This is your training dummy, huh?
Yeah, but what we have is explanted pig stomachs, and we sew into those little hoses, and then we can pump out cherry juice. And then the endoscopists can get a chance to train on this. There are other models as well which are electronic, but these are the most lifelike.
Those are lifelike for sure. You know, I'm going to resort to my best American. Get out of here! Pig stomachs and cherry juice.
Sounds like a nice Hungarian recipe.
You're cutting close to the bone there, Kai. Cutting close to the bone. Oh, dear, Hungarian cooking. First take something that used to be a pig. Yep, that's where it begins and ends. Where do we go from that particular discussion point? Well, I think we go to training and to cross-coverage and to the need for adult gastroenterologists who have a good deal of experience in handling acute GI bleeding to know what to do when the pediatric GI person is on holiday or off at a meeting and a kid comes in with acute GI hemorrhage. How are you going to organize cross-training as well as cross-coverage?
Yeah, well, we've published the ESGE, which is the adult organization for endoscopy, and ESPGHAN co-published the guidelines on this five years ago, in fact. And now we have the invidious position of when you're in a standalone children's hospital and you're running things, that's fine. But a lot of the patients sort of come into bigger hospitals, and then the inadequacy of paediatric training sometimes means that the adults are involved. And the adults don't want to be involved, especially with small children. So we run, in Sheffield, for instance, we run a two-day courses for adults and paediatric gastroenterologists. And we've got one coming up soon where we have GI bleeding with models and so forth. And the first day is all adult guys, and we teach on that. And the second day is all children's doctors, and the adults teach on that. So there's a bit of a movement towards co-training. I think that's really important, as you say, Alex, because you will be in the situation sometimes where you've got an adult gastroenterologist who's not prepared for reasons that may be insurance, or they're not familiar with the environment, or in fact the pathologies that children have, not wanting to do these on a child, and you may be in the position where, you know, the smaller centres, should we say, where you don't have paediatric gastroenterologists with the expertise, so the child is left betwixt in between these situations. My real push, I think, for the UK, for instance, is that we have four or five big centres where children are transported so that they all get decent treatment by very technically able paediatric endoscopists. And I think that probably is the way that we should be going, centralisation. And that should be rolled out across Europe as well, I believe.
I think you might find, although I can certainly be off base here, that works theoretically, and I hope concretely, in a single payer environment. But in Germany, for example, there are multiple financing organizations, and many hospitals see particular sets of patients as income sources, which militates against transferring patients out. So that one really needs to look at healthcare economics before centralization can be practiced as widely as possible. Am I off base there?
Yeah, I mean that is the problem with trying to mandate a certain system across the whole of Europe, because you've got such disparate health systems. You're absolutely right, but I think the challenge is to get around that, because if a child ends up in a place where the expertise isn't available, you know, this is the last time in our paediatric medicine where a child would die because of the lack of the skill of the doctor rather than the actual disease severity itself, if that makes sense.
It does. So which are the forms of GI bleeding then that can actually lead to a fatal outcome? It's been so long since I've encountered such a case, I must say. Diffuse viral gastritis and diffuse gastric hemorrhage, perhaps? Or how often do children vomit so severely that they induce a tear?
Yeah, well, as you will know, coming from a liver centre, the varices, of course, are important.
Varices.
Then you've got the post-influenza A, severe diffuse hemorrhagic gastritis. And the other one we've already mentioned today is the button batteries. So you must, if a child comes in with a big hematemesis, you must do a chest X-ray, because otherwise you'll miss that eventuality. Because a lot of the time they swallow them and you don't see them swallowing them, if that makes sense.
Okay, a chest X-ray. And right now you're thinking about erosion through the esophageal wall into a great vessel there in the tiger country of the mediastinum.
Absolutely right. And unfortunately they get stuck at the aortic notch, the bigger ones, and that's the worst place for them to get stuck.
Wow. Well, we've got guidelines in place. We've got training programs in place. The numbers of people who are to be considered adequately trained, both externally and from the point of view of self-confidence, are they approaching reasonable levels? Are the distributions approaching reasonable levels?
Well, you have always got a problem with volume of exposure of people to the number of cases. And that's why another good reason for having a centralisation effect, because you can run a 24-hour service with people that are competent. And yes, people are getting competent, but only in the big centres, because it's all about the numbers they see.
Isn't it? Okay. Well, there we are. We've had a little tour d'horizon of endoscopy and the emergencies that are associated with the need for endoscopy and when to move to endoscopy. And now, do you know, I used to date a woman who was a veterinary student, and she mocked me. She said, "You're just a one-species doctor. What do you want about?" Mike, you're not a one-species doctor anymore. Not anymore. You do endoscopies on dogs. Tell us about that.
Yes, as they say, a funny story comes to mind. I was in Australia working with the guys in Brisbane, and I worked there for about 5 or 6 years learning my endoscopy trade. And there was a girl who kept coming in with repeated Helicobacter infections. And we found out when we did EM of the mucosal biopsy of the stomach that actually it was a much longer Helicobacter organism than you would expect for pylori. It was used to be called Gastrospirillum hominis, or now called Helicobacter hilmani. And you only found that previously in cats and dogs.
Stop. I am so proud of my guild of the electron microscopists who act. But what possessed you to move to electron microscopy of those bugs?
Well, we thought they were looked at normal histology. You'll know this better than anyone. And they were about twice the length of the normal Helicobacter.
Uh-huh.
And so the histopathologist said, "Well, why don't we do EM? We'll find out a little bit more about this."
Right.
And so we did, and it was quite fascinating. So we then, like you, we had a researcher on our staff called Ristin Greer. She was a vet who was doing some work with us. And she said, "Well, let's take an old endoscope and we'll go out to the farm in the outback where this and we'll do endoscopy on the cats and the dogs and on the farm."
On the kitchen table.
We were in a barn. And and I tell you, it was quite entertaining because I know you've got a cat, but then sadly the story goes that the cat was going a bit blue when I was doing the endoscope, and I said to Ristin, it's blue, this cat, you know, we don't have that in pediatrics. And she said, "Oh, mate, if the cat makes up with a bit of brain damage, who's going to know?" And I was like,
"Oh,
what?
That is so not on." That is.
And so the denouement is basically we took biopsies from the cats and the dogs. We found the organism in the dogs. We treated the dogs and the girl at the same time. And hey presto, paper in the Lancet. And she got better and never got ill again. So it was a great story. It's a great story.
That is a great story. So there we have it. Endoscopy, the cure for all ills, men or beast.
Indeed.
All right. So, born in Yorkshire, father Scott, trained in Edinburgh, down to Sheffield, and dabbles in private work in London. You've got your choice of nations there, don't you? All through Britain. Which of those has produced the song that you'd like to share with us as a little bit of a reminder that Espigan is supranational, but it's also very intensely national, country by country? What's the song you'd like us to hear?
Well, I was going to go with Three Little Birds by Bob Marley, but I think we've had the football recently, which isn't my sport, I'm more rugby. And the reason I've chosen Sweet Caroline is because last week I was playing the Grinch in the local pantomime in Sheffield, and we finished off the whole pantomime with Sweet Caroline. And it's not like it's my favourite song, but it's just a very, very poignant memory. If I was going to do Desert Island Discs, that would be one of my choices.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, Espigan's Favourite Songs.
Thank you so much for making yourself available to Espigan and to this podcast series. I've enjoyed myself thoroughly, and I hope you have too.
Yeah, great to talk to you. Thanks a lot.